Genesis 42. We come today to the 42nd chapter of the book of Genesis in our studies in this book. It's found on pages 42 and 43 of the Pew Bible. Let us read God's word together this morning. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus, the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them. But he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "What do you come from?" Or "Where do you come from, rather?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan, to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them, and he said to them, "You are spies. You've come to this nakedness of this land, so they come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." He said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you've come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from the place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother, while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." They put them all together in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified and you shall not die." And they did so. Then they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. Now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in a sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys and their grain and departed. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of the sack. He said to his brothers, "My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack." At this, their hearts failed them. And they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" When they came to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man, the lord of the land, spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, 'We are honest men, we have never been spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the lord of the land, said to us, 'By this I shall know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me, and take grain for your famine of your households, and go your way. Bring your youngest to me, then I shall know that you are not spies but honest men, and I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land.' As they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob their father said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more. And now you would take Benjamin? All this has come against me.' Then Reuben said to his father, 'Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you.' But he said, 'My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol.'" And there we end our reading of God's word. I've often encouraged you to speak to your family and friends about their need of salvation. And with genuineness of heart, you've met me at the door and you've said to me, "I have prayed. I've prayed often, but they are hard of heart. I've prayed and I've seen very little response for my praying." I want to encourage you this morning to keep praying. I want you to keep persisting in that praying. Genesis chapter 39 or 37 rather, we have a scene before us which is not a good scene. It's a scene of 11 men standing round a pit in the ground, and there's a young teenage lad, lying in that pit. And they're discussing what they're going to do with this young lad. This young lad who has come to speak with them. They've taken him and they've stripped the clothes off his back. They've thrown him into this pit. The initial thought is that they're going to put him to death. And they debate whether they will put him to death. And then one in the gathering, he says, "No, let's not put him to death. Let's sell him instead. Why not make some money out of this situation?" And so they decide they're going to sell him. And at that time, there's a camel train going along. And we read in verses 26 and 27 that they take this young man out and they sell him. And we read in verse 28 of chapter 37, the book of Genesis, that they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And then what they do is they take the coat that they have taken off his back, they kill an animal, they dip that coat into the animal's blood, it's a goat, and they take the coat home and they engage in a pretense that this young lad, their brother, by the way, I forgot to say that, their brother, by the way, they engage in the pretense that he has been mauled by a wild animal, and that they discovered this garment, this coat that his father had given him, and this is all that remains of his existence. The scene, the sale, and the story they tell their father. And that was it. for 22 years. They got on with their lives, totally oblivious to what was happening in the life of their brother that they sold into slavery in Egypt and whom they pretend was dead. They knew nothing of the fact that it had been sold to the captain of the palace guard. We read about that in Genesis chapter 39. They know nothing of the fact of his rise to power within the Potiphar's house. How he became very influential, how he became responsible for the management of all that Potiphar had. How he had great success. They are ignorant of the fact that he was in prison due to an allegation that wasn't true made by Potiphar's wife. They knew nothing of his experiences in prison. Nothing of the dreams that the cupbearer, the cupbaker had, which he had interpreted. They were totally ignorant of the fact that he'd been elevated to a position of second in power in Egypt. The ring, the chariot, the command that all were to obey him, his work for 7 years in managing the abundance that had come upon that land, none of those facts were known to these men. They didn't know he was married. Didn't know he had two sons named Manasseh and Ephraim. They knew nothing about that. All they knew was that they had taken him out of a pit, they had sold him for 20 shekels of silver, and that he had been taken off into Egypt. These men had lived their lives day after day, year after year, for 22 years. And as far as they were concerned, Genesis chapter 42, verses 11 and verse 13, one is no more. One is no more. Their lives had gone on as though he were dead. They had almost convinced themselves that he was dead. Such had been the degree and the nature of their deceitfulness. Such had been the extent of their deceitfulness. And such had been the duration of their deceitfulness that they had reached a point now when they thought of Joseph, they thought automatically, he's no more. But note, there was still that nagging realization that he probably wasn't dead. Because they don't say he's dead, they say he's no more. Life goes on until it's time for God to draw them in. 22 years. 22 years of working the normal routine of life. 22 years until God draws them in. He draws them in. One word. One confrontation. One short period of time. One test. And one act of grace born of love. One word. God had appeared to Pharaoh, recorded for us in Genesis chapter 41, and he had troubled Pharaoh. He had given Pharaoh two dreams that proclaimed the same message. 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. The seven good cows that were fat had come up, and the seven lean cows that had come up. The seven lean cows had devoured the seven fat cows. The seven heads in the one stalk of grain. The seven blighted, weathered heads in the one stalk of grain, they had come up, and the blighted and weathered stalk had devoured the good stalk. God had used Joseph to interpret those dreams. And as a result, he had caused Joseph to be elevated to the position of second in command in all Egypt. Genesis chapter 41 and verse 40, we read how that you shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne I will be greater than you. He gets the signet ring, verse 42, from Pharaoh's hand. He is clothed in garments of fine linen and a gold chain put around his neck. He is made to ride in Pharaoh's second chariot. People will bow the knee and call out before him. He is set out over all the land of Egypt. He is given authority that no one will lift their hand or their foot in the land of Egypt unless Joseph says so. And for 7 years, the Lord blesses that land and the harvests are unbelievable. The value, the quality of the harvest is phenomenal. The quantity of the harvest is extraordinary. They fill the barns in every city. Such is the amount of food that's gathered in that they even cease from measuring it. There is so much food gathered in, it is absolutely unbelievable. Grain is tripping you wherever you go in Egypt. The man who has directed and orchestrated all that gathering in of that food and the storing of that grain is Joseph. And then the famine comes. The famine affects not only Egypt, but it affects the entire region. People flock to Egypt for grain. And who again is responsible for the sale of the grain? It is Joseph. God has been directing events here, affecting many tens of thousands of people's lives to achieve one thing, to bring Jacob and his family, 70 in total, into Egypt. All this grand nation, all the harvests that are gathered in, the years of famine, the heartache, the struggles, the tensions within families, the pressures, the anxieties, all done for the purpose of bringing Jacob and his family down into this land. They're in Canaan. There's no food in Canaan. And we read chapter 42, verse 1. Jacob learns that there's grain for Egypt. He sits down and he talks to his sons and he says, "Right, lads, we have no food on the table. There's none to be had in Canaan. You need to go down into Egypt to get the food there because we've heard there's plenty of grain in Egypt." They don't get up and go immediately. There's hesitation. There's almost the implication here that Jacob has to come to him 2, 3, 4, 5 times in order to get them to think about this. And this is not like Jacob saying to the son who's lying in front of the television, "Away up and tidy your room." What we're talking about here is Jacob saying to his sons, "You need to go and get food to put food in your wife's stomach and your wife's stomach. This is important. This is important." And yet they're dithering and dallying about. And he eventually says to him in verse 1, "Why are you looking at one another? Why are you standing there gaping at one another? What's to be had by looking at one another? There's no grain in Canaan. Looking at one another is not going to solve the issue. There's grain in Egypt. Get on your camels, get on your horses, and get down there and get some grain brought up here so that we can eat." And why does this mention of this word Egypt cause these men to recoil? Why does it cause them to stand and look at one another? Is it because they don't want to go to Egypt to get the food? Is it that they're timorous individuals who the thought of going to Egypt is going to cause them great distress? No, we'll see in a minute or two that far from being timorous, these guys were hard men, very hard men. Very hard men. So it's not the fear of going into Egypt that's holding these men back. It's not that they're meek and mild and gentle individuals that's holding them back. There's something else that's causing them. Whenever the old man says to them, away down to Egypt, they stand and look at each other and think, we don't want to go there. One word, Egypt. Why does this cause them grief? Well, this one word, Egypt, speaks to them of a pit, a cloak, a brother, 20 shekels of silver, and a camel train heading off into the distance. Egypt spells their dealing with Joseph. 22 years have passed. 22 years of suppressing the truth. 22 years of pressing it down. 22 years of deceit. 22 years of lies. 22 years of watching the old man every day, his heart broken, the loss of a son. 22 years looking into his eyes saying, we know the truth, but we're not telling you. And suddenly, Egypt. Egypt. Some in and Levi. In Genesis chapter 34, when their sister Dinah had been raped, went to the men and did it and said, let's strike a deal. You can marry her, but you need to be circumcised. So the guys in Shechem said, well, okay. He really, really loves her. He shouldn't have done what he did to her. He shouldn't have done that. He loves her. So let's get circumcised. And the guys are lying there in pain. And what does Simeon and Levi go in and do? Put them all to death. Reuben, chapter 35, goes in and sleeps with his father's concubine. He goes in and sleeps with one of his father's wives. Judah chapter 38 has two sons killed because of their wickedness, and then he goes in and sleeps with his daughter-in-law, thinking that she's a prostitute, and then when she gets pregnant and he hears about this daughter-in-law of his getting pregnant, he wants her brought out, and he wants her dealt with, and he wants her dealt with now, and he wants her dealt with in the way that the law says she must be dealt with, until somebody says to him, actually, well, you're the guy getting to bed with her, and this child's yours. These men were hard men. These men could take life. These men could sleep with their father's wives. These men had no problem with sleeping with prostitutes. These men could demand moral penalty for the sin of the people in their family when they were the ones who had caused that very sin. And yet one word, Egypt, sends shivers down their back. One word sends them into a tailspin. 22 years, one word. There are people that you love, and they are hard to the gospel. They are hard to the gospel. And you've taken occasion to speak to them of God and the things of God and the love of God, and yet they're hard. They're congenial, and they're polite, and they'll talk to you about the church, and they'll even take an interest in the church, and they'll be pleased to be you in the church. But in reality, you speak to them of their need of seeking Christ, and they, with even all the beautifulness of their face, are hard to the core. Hard to the core. And you think, will they ever change? I've prayed over them for months. These men, it took 22 years before one word began to shake their consciences. 22 years before one word from God through the lips of their father was sufficient to cause them to stop and think. So I would encourage you to pray, and not to cease from praying. A month, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, how many years does it take? It doesn't matter how many years it takes. The object is that God, through one or two words, will speak to them and awaken their conscience. It doesn't matter if it takes you now to the end of your life. What does it matter if it takes you to the end of your life if all they hear is that one word from God that will awaken their conscience? That's all that matters, yes? You would like it to happen tomorrow. Yes, you would like them to hear next Sunday. Yes, you would like in 6 months to become members of this church. Yes, you would like to see their children baptized. Yes, you would like to see them sit here and worship with you and enjoy fellowship with you. But the reality is that will probably not happen. We should expect it to happen, but it probably won't happen. Does that mean we give up? No. 22 years of suppressing the truth. 22 years of ignoring it. 22 years of saying, we're not going to admit this fact that what we did. Egypt. One word. One confrontation. They come to Egypt. Note how seriously Joseph takes his responsibilities. He doesn't delegate the selling of the food to other people. I did my job, I got it all gathered in, let someone else do the job of selling it. No, in verse 6, he takes the responsibility of selling the food as well. Joseph recognized them, his brothers, but they don't recognize him. Why? Because of his clothes. And in verse 23, he's speaking in an Egyptian. He's using an interpreter. Joseph confronts his brothers. He doesn't embrace them at this point and say how pleased he is to see them, because they have done wrong against him and God. And there is a need for them to be confronted with that fact. There is no point in embracing one who does wrong and says it's okay. It is not good to reaffirm to ungodly, disbelieving people the fact that what they're doing is right. We must confront their wrongdoing directly and personally. No point in condoning by our presence or our words the fact that what they're doing may not be all right, but we think it's okay. If it's wrong, it's wrong. And what he does is he confronts them. Where do you come from? From the land of Canaan to buy food. Verse 8 tells us that he recognized them, didn't recognize him. He remembers the dreams of chapter 17, verse 7, the binding of the sheaves. His sheaf rises up, theirs bow down. And verse 9, the sun, the moon, the 11 stars bow down to him. These are going through his head. He accuses them of being spies. Why? Well, one commentator puts it that maybe they had accused him of being a spy. And I like that thought. Remember back in Genesis chapter 37, verse 2, how he had gone to see his brothers and how he had brought a bad report back. Is it possible that when he went to them at the father's request to find them, that they saw him coming and said, there he is, come and he's spying us again. No doubt he'll take another bad report back to the old boy. And was it the fact that they challenged him concerning his being a spy, that now he then brings this up, this charge against them being a spy? I thought there's going to be something in that. I mean, what was there to spy in the land? Nobody had anything. He speaks of the land as being a naked land. You come in here to spy the nakedness of the land. He confronts them. He remembers the truth concerning what God says. He doesn't at this point get carried away with emotion. Oh, my brothers. Look, there they are. He remembers that he's a man of God. Remember how we've seen at each stage in this man's life, he remembers what? He remembers the man of God in Potiphar's house. He remembers the man of God with Potiphar's wife. He remembers the man of God in prison. He remembers the man of God before Pharaoh. Now he's remembering as a man of God before his brothers. He never ceases to be a man of God. Is it any wonder that God raised him to a prominent position? Is it any wonder that God used this man to be the savior of his people? Maybe at some time it's because we're afraid to be men and women of God that God doesn't use us in the way that we could be used. Do you maybe wonder sometimes why your family don't walk in the ways of God? Is it because of the mixed signals you're sending out to them? Is it because you're saying, I'm a man of God and it suits me, but I'm a man of God and it doesn't suit me other times? Is there clarity in what you're doing as a man or a woman of God in relation to your family? This guy walked consistently through what he was doing. Consistently. There was no break in what he was doing. He was consistently walking in the ways of God. He accuses them of being spies. See, he doesn't rush in to deal with the past and saying it's okay. He sees that God's at work and is prepared to let God do his work. We need to let God do his work. Or sometimes in our families when we have to confront them. Confront them. They want us to do something, we've got to say, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. It's not what God wants me to do, and I can't do that. Got to be clear, got to be straight, got to be honest with them. What's at stake? It's their eternity that's at stake. It's their eternity that's at stake. But I don't want to break friendship with them. Well, maybe you need to break friendship with them to make them feel as though they're missing something. Maybe that hardness of heart that they have to the things of God is being reinforced by your attitudes and your actions at key moments in their lives when you should be saying to them, no. You're saying yes. And when you should be saying yes, you're saying no. He confronts them. One short period of time, they had been thrown into the pit. He had been thrown into the pit. He had spent years in prison. Now they're going to experience prison for 3 nights. Joseph sends them to the prison. And it's during this one short period of time that they begin to think and talk. The reality of what they did 22 years ago begins to come to the forefront of their minds. They say to one another, verse 21, we are guilty concerning our brother. In truth, we are guilty. They have protested themselves to be honest men. Now they are being honest. In that we saw the distress of a soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. One short period of time away from the everyday affairs of life. And God uses that one short period of time to awaken their conscience to the situation, the context, and the evil that they had undertaken 22 years previously. Reuben, the eldest, pipes up. Did I not tell you not to sin against this boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. Isn't it wonderful when God uses a word or words to draw people to the truth of who they are? Isn't it wonderful when God uses the confrontation, whether through the preached word or through the word of a relative, to say to someone, you need to stop and you need to think about who you are and you need to think about your eternity? And isn't it wonderful when someone by God's grace sits down and is honest with themselves concerning who they are and concerning their eternal future? Isn't it wonderful when a man or a woman gets to that point in their life when they say, in truth, I am guilty. In truth, I have done wrong against God. In truth, the reckoning of his blood, the blood of Christ, is upon me because I was there being for his death. I was there being for his death. Pray for your loved ones. You need to pray for the people that you love. Enable you to confront them with who they are. To be direct. I'm not talking about being aggressively arrogant with them, but be direct. You can be lovingly direct with someone. You can say, I'm really sorry, we're not doing this. Or I can't do this, or I will do that. Because this is the way of God, and we must stick to the way of God. Because only in the way of God will you see the truth of God. And only when you see the truth of God will you be brought to a conscious awareness of your guilt before God. And only when you're aware of your guilt before God will you seek God with all your heart. And I will pray to God that you will be aware of that guilt. Men had had proclaimed their honesty, had they been honest, was Reuben honest when he went in and slept with his father? Was Judah honest when he lied to his daughter-in-law regarding his third youngest son? Were they being honest here when they said, "Our brother is no more"? These guys didn't know what honesty is. And Joseph says to them, or Pharaoh says to them, I'm going to test your honesty. I'm going to see if your words are verified. Verse 20. And so your words will be verified and you will not die. He says to them, I'm going to test you and see if your words are true. Verse 16. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether this is true or not. And he holds Simeon. Now I wonder if Simeon was the guy who had agitated for him to put into the grave. I wonder if Joseph said, I'm not sending Simeon down because it's the ways of God, but we want to see, is this a real conversion? Is this true? Do you have a real yearning for the things of God? Are you giving yourself to God? Is there a reality about this? It's not easy praying for those, but God can use one word after 22 years.